Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Maybe you noticed this if you were paying attention to the news over the weekend. The embattled investment banking firm Goldman Sachs got a big vote of confidence from homespun investing genius Warren Buffett at his annual Berkshire Hathaway shareholders meeting in Omaha. We're going to talk about Buffett and Goldman and collateralized debt obligations with Michael Lewis and his new book, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. He writes about some of the players who, like Goldman Sachs, managed to make money off the economic bubble bursting. And there are so many developments in this area, of course, that it's good to catch up with Michael Lewis again. Michael, welcome back to WNYC.
No, thanks for having me back.
So you wrote a column for Bloomberg Businessweek where you start with a little satirical sympathy for the poor Goldman Sachs bond traders. You write, "You did nothing worse than live by the ethical assumptions of your market. Any money-making event, short of obviously illegal, is admirable. And now your own grandfather thinks you're some kind of monster." So what were you trying to say?
What I said. I think that we're living through this period where all of a sudden the bond markets are being scrutinized in a way they just haven't been since they became really central to Wall Street's life in the 80s. And you've got Goldman Sachs is the reason I think that it's got to feel a little bit unfair being inside Goldman Sachs is I don't think they did anything that at least several other big Wall Street firms did too, and yet they're being they've been selected out to be investigated, and so they're put in this very awkward position of defending what is pretty indefensible. I mean, when you back away from the business, and all of a sudden you see that these firms that are meant to be brokerage firms are essentially colluding with short sellers to create securities that are designed to fail, and then peddle them to the dumbest investors they can find, thus introducing a sort of pollution into the financial system. I mean, whatever that is, it's not good for the world. It may not be strictly illegal. We'll find out, but it should be. And it was pretty standard practice a few years ago to do such a thing.
The reason Warren Buffett's defense of Goldman made news, I think, is that he is seen, despite his immense riches and, you know, acquired through investing, he is seen as a relative honest broker by many people. He's seen as a relative Mr. Clean, though he does have investment ties to Goldman. What do you make of what Warren Buffett said?
Well, look, I think he is a relatively honest broker, but he doesn't just have investment ties to Goldman. He has a $5 billion stake, and he gets paid $500 million a year in interest from Goldman from that stake, and he's playing a role with Goldman Sachs that he played with my old firm, Salomon Brothers. In the late 80s, Salomon Brothers was in distress, needed capital and needed Buffett's good name, and they rented it. They paid him a fortune in a security that no normal investor could buy. They essentially gave him a sweet deal to come in and be an angel and provide not just capital but a kind of moral support to the firm. And he's done this again with Goldman Sachs. And the odd thing about it is after his experience with Salomon Brothers, which went very sour after a while, I mean, that he comes in, saves the firm from a hostile takeover, and then a couple of years later finds himself embroiled in this huge scandal where the firm is being threatened with extinction by the federal government because it lied to the Treasury about manipulating the Treasury market. And in the end, Buffett washes his hands of the whole thing and says he's never going to get involved with another big Wall Street firm again. And he's gone and done it. I mean, I think that the price was better this time, but he's in exactly the same situation, and he behaved the same way then. As he's doing now, that faced with the bad news that the firm may have done something really awful, his first response was the defense mode. He's talking his own book. He's defending his own interest. As this Goldman case lawsuit plays out and more facts come to light, it's going to be interesting to see how he plays it.
I've read that you thought that after your book Liar's Poker came out in 1989, that the big risk-taking on Wall Street big stupid risk-taking on Wall Street was over, only to be writing about the same behaviors again today. Is it inevitable, or what's the lesson to be learned?
Well, it's essentially what I think happened was from the time I wrote Liar's Poker in the late 80s to The Big Short now, that I think that Wall Street changed in lots of ways. These firms became very sanitized on the surface anyway. They became more like, they looked more like normal corporations, and abnormal or any kind of behavior in these firms that attracted media scrutiny was squashed, all in the interest of preserving the financial arrangements. And but now things really have changed now. I mean, there is the trouble that these firms' behaviors caused for the rest of the society now has created this public referendum on whether they should exist in their current form. And I do think that serious financial reform is going to happen. This bill is going to pass in some form, and it's just a question of what's in it at this point.
It does allow them to remain in existence in more or less their current form, doesn't it?
No. You may know more than I do.
I doubt that very much.
From hour to hour, what seems to be politically possible is changing. But if, for example, the so-called Volcker Rule is included in the legislation, so the firms are not allowed to trade for their own books, the securities they're advising their customers to buy and sell, that would have a huge effect on, say, Goldman Sachs. I mean, it would essentially divide Goldman Sachs into two companies. That some large part of Goldman Sachs would have to go off and do what they do to make money somewhere else. And so that would have a very big effect. The derivatives legislation, the idea that if you're going to trade something, you can no longer trade it behind closed door with a single counterparty. It has to be done through a clearinghouse. That will have a big effect on the volumes in the market. The things that are being bandied about right now and seriously considered and likely to happen will have a very big effect on the shape of these firms.
Do you think there's too much cynicism then about the inability of the law to affect the banks on both left and right in this country? Because I hear a lot of people on both sides saying, yeah, even with the Volcker Rule, even bringing the derivatives trading onto open exchanges, firms like Goldman are still going to be too big to fail. And so ultimately, the potential for a taxpayer bailout is still there. And ultimately, they're going to find whatever loopholes for the next, huge secret money-making crazy market. And so ultimately, there won't be much of an effect.
I think people are too cynical about it, because I think two things. One is both Democrats and Republicans agree that too big to fail is unacceptable. Everybody's agreed on this point. So it's just a technical question of how you avoid being in this situation. And there are lots of ideas being bandied about that would solve it. I mean, absolute limits on the size of the firms is one idea that's still alive. Strict leverage rules is still alive. That would have a very big effect on the size of the firms. I can understand where the cynicism comes from, that we've lived through a very long period in American history where the basic attitude of Washington towards Wall Street was we should keep our hands off, and that we only make things worse when we meddle in the markets. And this has led to anemic regulation. It's led to an unwillingness to engage legislatively with new products that are created on Wall Street. But we are obviously in a very different world right now. I mean, the politics are completely changed. I mean, Washington is not going to leave its hands off Wall Street. There's no way. So the culture shifted is what's happened. That the people on Wall Street have gone from being a kind of, an unquestioned master class to effectively enemies of the people, and the people are not happy. So I do think that we are in a period where dramatic reform is not just possible, but quite likely.
Michael Lewis, my guest on WNYC, his book, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. I have to ask this question of any guest who comes on and talks about this topic, because we are a New York radio station. I don't know where you live, but these changes that you think are going to be big and inevitable, have you thought about what the impact on New York will be?
Well, I live in Berkeley, so the impact on Berkeley will be very small.
Certainly, the intellectual impact on Berkeley will be very small.
Yeah, well, that's true too, but also the financial impact. We don't have a lot of hedge funds in Berkeley, I guess I think this, that the real question isn't the impact on New York. The real question is the impact on the global economy, that we have lived through a period where Wall Street, the way it's structured, has squandered trillions of dollars. At the same time, it's paid itself more money than it's ever paid itself. That there's clearly a totally screwed up incentive system and an enterprise finance, which is meant to enable wealth, enable the creation of wealth, has been instead enabling the destruction of wealth. And that's bad for everybody, including New Yorkers. I think that whatever the financial industry looks like at the end of this reform process, it's going to be centered in New York City, and it's still going to be profitable. But possibly not as profitable. So it's possible that this sector of the New York City economy will not be as lively as it was, nor should it be. I mean, this enterprise has been far too highly compensated for a long time. So that the number of people walking out of big Wall Street firms into the Maserati dealership probably should decline. but maybe other aspects of the New York economy will benefit as a result.
Michael, I was surprised to see that Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, who's been very tough on the bank, she's been one of those folks, as you know, that people who want to be tough on the banks have been cheering when she opens her mouth a little bit more unvarnished than some others in the Obama administration. She came out in defense of the investment banks being able to continue to do derivatives trading rather than having to spin those operations off, as I guess is in the Volcker rule. Does that surprise you in her case?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. This just happened, yesterday, didn't it?
Over the last couple of days.
I saw a headline, and I haven't had time to parse her argument. I don't know exactly why she thinks what she thinks.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to guess, what she thinks is that if you force them to spin their derivative tradings out into other units, non-bank units, that you create the situation once again where important parts of the financial world are just outside of her ability to regulate it.
Yeah, her argument is that the trades would be better regulated in the banking system.
That may be true. That may be true. It's not. I don't think the Volcker rule. The Volcker rule is not this. What you're talking about is not just the Volcker rule.
Mm-hmm.
It's a separate idea. The Volcker rule is about the firms being able to essentially make bets for their own accounts. Against their customers, so therefore have an incentive to, say, create bonds that are going to blow up so they can bet against them. It's a separate section of the legislation.
Before you go, the praise for your book has been almost universal. I did see one criticism that it was the very people you profiled who prolong the crisis, because if I understand the author's point, their interest in shorting these bonds encouraged firms like Goldman Sachs to keep putting these deals together. Or maybe that's the point you were trying to make as well. Is there anything
well,
to that?
I actually do make that point. The question is, what is their? Then there's the moral question: were these people bad or good? Were they heroes or villains? And I think it's a little hard to lay the financial crisis at the feet of a handful of basically small-time hedge fund managers who didn't make the loans, package the loans, sell the loans off to other people, who were just merely doing their job of trying to figure out what the smart thing to do with money was. So it's while it's true that the Wall Street firms, essentially, what they did is they perverted the role of the short seller. That typically in a market, a short sell is very important. In the first place, the ability to sell short creates an incentive for negative information to find its way into the marketplace, which is important for any sort of efficient market. But secondly, when someone's selling something short, what they're doing is, in most cases, depressing the price of the thing and making it less desirable, and therefore creating less of it. What Wall Street did we're not going to want to go into what a synthetic CDO is, but they essentially use the short seller's bets to manufacture more of the bad bonds that caused so many problems. But the idea that this was the cause of the crisis is nuts, and the idea that the people who were actually making the smart bets are somehow the villains of the piece is also crazy. But you, as you must know, you can't write a book, especially a book that does really well, without someone being upset. So I'm glad that's what they're upset about. Because there are other things I would say about it that are much less kind.
Oh, you don't want to go there, though, right?
We don't have time for that, I'm sorry.
I guess so. And I did say that the book has gotten almost universal praise. And Michael Lewis, I always learn a lot when I read your stuff, so it's always good to have you on the show. As always, Michael Lewis's new book is The Big Short: Inside the Doomsday Machine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. David Isay next.